hearing on Senate Bill 142. If you'd like to continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was talking about recruitment of jobs in a small community, communities such as Lakeview, success is very limited. Recruitment is difficult because of the remote rural setting and size of the available workforce. Lake County is the second most sparsely populated county in the state. The density of Lake County averages less than one person per square mile. Goes without saying, Lakeview, the county seat, with 55% of the population of Lake County, is a rural community. The nearest interstate highway is 175 miles away. Although a state and federal highway intersect in Lakeview, major markets for potential producers are also approximately 175 miles away, both to the north and to the west, and further to the east and to the south. In addition, our state highway 140, which is one of our major routes for trucking, has load restrictions and length restrictions on it for segments of our highway east of Lakeview. Needless to say, these are things that are difficult to recruit a business that needs to market its products. The other job creation factor is retention and expansion of existing businesses. However, businesses need to make a profit. Profits are made, among other things, by sales, and as the population begins to decline, the earning power of the workforce declines, sales decline. This has a direct effect on some of the companies. I'd like to use our local coast-to-coast store, for example. The owner of the coast-to-coast store has wanted to expand his business, but because of declining sales due to the loss of population and high-income job producers, he's actually had to cut back his workforce. It became critically clear to the folks in Lake County and in Lakeview that to survive and retain some semblance of social and economic conditions, the residents must have Lake County, and the communities within Lake County had to diversify and move away from the dependence on timber and agriculture. As discussed earlier, recruitment is difficult. Unless we could attract businesses that were environmentally friendly, did not have to depend on difficult highway situations to get their products to market, could function without the benefits of natural gas, or had families that were content without shopping malls, and the list goes on. We had to do something different. Recognizing the importance and availability of high-tech communications capability in our information society, Lake County chose to pursue telecommunications as a potential new job generator, an economic driver. Telecommunications appeared to offer environmentally friendly jobs, which everybody in the community says that's what we need. It was imperative that we attempted to do this. It was imperative that we brought the community up to speed on what the power and opportunities in telecommunications were. In the summer of 1996, Jeff Ritter of OEDD and Laurie Itkin of the governor's staff came to Lakeview and made a very positive presentation to the county commissioners. This was a significant day as it set in motion the framework for the creation of telecommunications awareness in Lake County. Efforts to bring economic recovery to the area through increased use of telecommunications technology began to unfold. The terms telecenter and bandwidth became part of our vocabulary. The creation of a telecenter for public access became a target and a goal. A central location was sought to get the people tuned into what the potential was. We were able to, with the help of OEDD, convert an old abandoned fire hall, which belonged to the town of Lakeview, into a new, very modern appearing telecenter. It is doubtful we would be here, we would have the telecenter now without the cooperation of the town of Lakeview. We call our telecenter the Lake Cyber Outpost, and it is a result of the county and town's commitment, along with other partners, including the Oregon Economic Development Department, Regional Strategies, a local Collins McDonald Trust Fund, Lake County, the town of Lakeview, the Klamath Lake Employment Training Institute, Klamath, Treasure Valley Community Colleges, Pacific Power and Light. Additional cash donations from private businesses and residents totaled more than $3,000. This project was an important step in diversifying the economy of Lakeview and Lake County. Initially, focus was on acquainting and familiarizing the community with opportunities and resources available through telecommunications. It now provides an opportunity for the public to experience the power of the Internet, intranet opportunities, video conferencing, and electric mail capabilities. The long-term impacts are more significant in terms of effects on the community. By connecting local entities with each other, which Senate Bill 142 will do, the Telecenter will open doors to economic opportunities. This will result in exposure to job opportunities as well as increased sales of specialized goods currently experiencing marketing difficulties. The Telecenter, frankly, has the potential to provide training for the employed and disadvantaged workers. I would call your attention to a second handout that you've received called the Oregon Labor Trends. And if you'll turn to the back page, you'll see highlighted in the conclusion section on page 3, in order for rural communities to join in the growth, they must be able to provide a better educated workforce and access to high-speed information networks. We've attempted to do that. Unfortunately, if the dire predictions I referred to in my opening comments come true, these efforts will stagnate and for even worse, be for naught. We simply cannot proceed with our attempts to recruit data processing or other telecommunications firms if we lose what limited communications we have in areas such as Lake County. That is why I, on behalf of our commissioners, feel a Senate Bill 142 must become a reality. We absolutely need fiber optics. It is an absolutely critical piece of our infrastructure. Frankly put, we cannot compete with areas that already had fiber optics. I mentioned earlier we have digital communications companies. One of the first questions they ask is, do you have fiber optics? If we say no, we don't get the first chance. We don't get a chance to compete. We've been told that, as I mentioned earlier, that digital communications will provide for the needs of the data processing companies. This is not something that they will listen to or take our word for. As I'm sure you've noticed, we're very proud of what we've accomplished. With the generous assistance of the state of Oregon and other public and private entities, Lake County and the community of Lakeview are committed to advancing telecommunications in rural eastern Oregon. It is our belief that telecommunications is a viable means to improving the economic situation in Lake County and other similar remote eastern Oregon counties. It is certainly in the best interest of the overall state economy to include rural areas and communities in the recovery from the timber situation. We believe that the commitment to rural Oregon that Senate Bill 142 fosters is good for Lake County and for Oregon. Again, in summary, I would again refer you to this particular brochure, which is recently out. The highlighted areas, I think, will give testimony to several issues which I have testified to regarding the need for bandwidth to provide for the capability of businesses to become established and the lack of inadequate infrastructure and workforce training are barriers to expansion of existing industries. We just want a chance to compete. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to offer my support to Senate Bill 142. The beneficiaries will be the people of Lakeview, Lake County, as well as the state of Oregon. Oregon needs counties such as Lake and communities such as Lakeview to be a great state. It is essential that these entities are prepared for the 21st century. This concludes my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any additional questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Radke? Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you have a conversation with Century? Have you talked to Century in terms of if 142 becomes law, in terms of are they willing to look to invest in extending fiber optics to Lakeview?
I've talked to Bill Weinman, perhaps not specifically directed at 142, but they have made a commitment to connect Lakeview with Bly this summer. We have that on record. We have a letter from CenturyTel. It is our understanding that CenturyTel will then extend the fiber from Bly to Malin, which is south of Klamath Falls, next year, which should tie us. What we need, and I do not have a commitment yet at this point, actually is a loop connecting Lakeview also with Burns, so we have the circular loop to really give us the communications capability we need.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Redkey.
Thank you.
Tom, in the interest of time, and you're around a little bit more often, I think, aren't you? And
I am. So I am close by.
What I'd like to ask you to do is, I mean, go ahead and give us testimony, but if you can kind of summarize it as opposed to...
I can do that. Thank you. Chair Cromwell and committee, my name is Tom Cook. I'm the director of the Oregon Public Education Network, which represents providing telecommunications connectivity and Internet access as well as teacher resources and training materials to the schools across the state. And I want to also say that I've also submitted to the committee administrator testimony by Kurt Pedersen, the Associate Provost of Oregon State University, and also Joanne Hughey, the Director of the Computing Center at the University of Oregon. Those materials are now in your packets as well on their testimony on 142. Let me tell you about the K-12 success story and why I'm here. 3 years ago, 1996 era, we had 200 schools connected in the state with any kind of telecommunications capability. Today, we have only 154 that are not connected. So we're now well over 1,000 schools across the state that are, in fact, connected. So you might be asking, well, if that's the case, why are you here in support of this kind of a bill? We have been successful because of a project, or the fast packet contract that the state entered into, which basically provided us with 56 and T1 capability throughout the state. This was an affordable telecommunication access provided to us and has allowed us to make this kind of growth. What we're facing today is the same kind of an environment that we were in 96, and that is that we are now ready to expand into higher levels of bandwidth through our needs in the application areas, and are now finding that in a lot of the areas of the state we cannot do that, or that as we begin planning for that, that kind of infrastructure in fact is not in place. So that's why I'm here in support of the concept of 142, which builds a statewide infrastructure, or a version of 142, whatever the case may be. From the school's perspectives across the state, they're not into regulatory issues. They're not into price capping, rate of return, or those kinds of issues. What they do have an interest in is being able to have, as it is needed, the resources to be able to provide structure through infrastructure, the kinds of things that we're going to need in the classroom. In trying to meet the new educational standards of CIM and CAM, we know that we're going to have to move into areas of delivery of educational content, curriculum, and resources through things like cyber school, online internet classes, and also now into two-way interactive video. As the new standards are being implemented, we're finding that some of the schools across the state are struggling with their ability to either hire the teachers in the areas of certification that they need, and or even if they had the money to attract them, getting them to come to some of the other areas of the state. So we believe that through a distance education program that we will be able to provide some of those resources that are so grossly needed across the state. And what we're trying to plan for at this point is the delivery of that. So a concept of 142 is to, in fact, provide that kind of infrastructure at the higher bandwidth needs that will support voice, video, and data as we need to integrate those services together. So I'm here today in support of that kind of an infrastructure build-out. And if it's through the process as we have defined in 142, that's great. If it's through a modification of that, I'll support that as well. All I'm asking you is that we have achieved or your support of this kind of an activity, because 142 has achieved one thing, and that's to raise the level of visibility on the needs of this entire state for telecommunications infrastructure. And just one more point before Representative Hill asked me the question about the E-rate. In K-12, in the year one, Oregon
schools have in fact received over $9 million in E-rate funding. And through year two submissions, we know that it exceeds that, but I don't have an accurate number in total application for year two, but that we know that it will in fact exceed the $9 million. So in summary, I support the concept of 142 or any method of bringing telecommunications infrastructure to K-12 throughout the state.
Representative thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, what percentage of schools applied for federal E-rate dollars?
I don't have a percentage.
Yes. How many schools? How many applications were sent in? Do you know?
I'm sorry, I don't have that information, but I will provide it to you. I do have it in my office, a complete list. So, Chair Crummell, Representative Hill, I will get you that information.
Great, thank you.
Representative Montgomery?
Mine's a Montgomery technical question, because I know enough to be dangerous about this whole subject. We're talking about loops going, and Mr. Radke from Lakeview said if we don't get it into Lakeview, the loop will come from Klamath Falls to Lakeview and into Burns. What about North Lake County? What about Summer Lake, beautiful Summer Lake that you just mentioned? What about Paisley? What about Christmas Valley? Will they be eliminated, or does what happens? I'm just relating to rural Oregon. That's real rural. Yeah.
The difficulty
will be getting it Paisley, Summer Lake, Christmas Valley, Fort Rock, those communities connected. Obviously, the ideal then would be to tie in with Bend. I mentioned the Burns route seems, to some degree, the most practical to provide a circular loop. Bend and Burns is connected. Klamath Falls is connected to Bend, a loop that does not take care of the Paisley-Christmas Valley connection that you're talking about. And it is hoped that we could certainly go beyond that to connect these areas as well. That's part of our whole approach.
Mr. Chairman, the reason for my question, we're acting as if this is a godsend for Eastern Oregon. What about Fossil? What about Condon? What about Monument? There's a lot of Eastern Oregon that is not going to be the godsend. So this may not be all it's primed up to be the miracle that's going to take care of Eastern Oregon. We've got a lot of Eastern Oregon. Thank you.
I don't know, Peter. Either one of you want to respond, or is it a rhetorical
question? If I might, Representative Crummell, the primary goal in drafting this bill was to reach just those kinds of places, that we knew that eventually that we could drive, or that telecommunications might be driven to the bigger rural centers, but there was no hope, there was no way that competition was going to spur the placement of infrastructure into places like Fossil, like Christmas Valley, and it is hoped that in the joint planning between the telecommunications carriers and these communities that the monies from Senate Bill 142 can in fact provide that kind of infrastructure to those communities.
Lakeview yes. Is a metropolitan area compared to Plush, so we have other brothers.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Let's see. Next, I guess I would like to call up, we have an incumbent provider panel, which is representatives from GTE, Sprint, U.S. Western Central.
Apparently, I've been elected to go first. Chairman Hill, Chairman Crummell, members of the committee, I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Legislative Affairs Manager for GTE. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 142. I'm not going to go through all my testimony. I'm just going to kind of hit the highlights.
Thank you.
You're welcome. One of the things I'd like to talk about a little bit is the kind of service that GTE provides. All of our customers, both rural and urban, are served by digital service switches and have one-party service. In 1998, fully 41% of GTE's Oregon capital budget was spent in rural areas for a total of more than $28 million, even though only 27% of our customers are actually outside the greater Portland area. I also wanted to talk a little bit about LeGrand. I think many of you know that LeGrand has been trying for quite a long time to get access to fiber and a POP in that area. They have several providers have put fiber optics through LeGrand, but there was no off-ramp where the folks who actually live in LeGrand could access that fiber. And over time, GTE had discussions with several of the inter-exchange carriers that owned the fiber in that area to see if they'd be interested in building a point of presence, which is an off-ramp, in or near the LeGrand area. It was very difficult for those providers to build a business case for doing that. It would cost anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000 to do that. And so we weren't very successful in finding a provider that was interested. However, last fall and winter, LeGrand, in cooperation with the Oregon Economic Development Department, was able to interest the Oregon Dental Society in locating a claim processing center in LeGrand. Once they indicated that LeGrand was the first choice for their location, we started looking again for somebody who would be interested in providing a POP, and we were successful in finding an inter-exchange carrier, Touch America, who was interested in at least exploring the possibility of building a POP in LeGrand. But they did think that based on what their cost estimate was, which was the lower end, about $200,000, that they would either need significant incremental customer usage or alternatively some assistance with the capital costs of building the POP or some subsidy of its operating costs. At this point, community leaders in LeGrand began soliciting local businesses to see what kinds of additional services they might be interested in purchasing if they had the opportunity. They went to government agencies and educational institutions, also asking those same kinds of questions and asking them to communicate those needs to both GTE and Touch America. Also, Union County looked at the possibility of making funds available to incent Touch America. And ultimately, between the county's interest in providing some upfront funding for Touch America, GTE's investment in the fiber to connect our existing facilities to Touch America's POP, and the community support with businesses and the potential support of the state's enterprise network, we were able to put together a deal to bring a POP to LeGrand. And that all of that is anticipated to be operational on or before July 12th, which is when ODS wants to be up and running. I think that's a good example both of what the difficulties are in attracting telecommunications infrastructure to rural areas, but also it's a very good example of how communities and government and private enterprise can work together to come up with solutions.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shelley, in statute, in terms of as an incumbent provider, you have an obligation to serve the service territories. And with the changing economic conditions in terms of advances in technologies, we've created a situation in rural or other areas in terms of where we have communities where, as GTE says, you know, you have digital switches serving all of your areas. So in the local area, following me, you know, between me and my neighbor,
right,
he goes to a digital switch, but then how it gets to the rest of the world becomes a bottleneck because the interconnections are either digital radio, which have atmospheric issues and those types of things. Do you think, in terms of GTE's obligation to serve, requires an incumbent to look at making sure that the communities that they have this obligation to serve are interconnected out to the rest of the world in such a way that they have the ability to serve? I mean, because in terms of, as needs are there are being demanded, in terms of LeGrand has been is a prime example in terms of for years they've been clamoring for high bandwidth capacity, which was unavailable over the digital radio, and so by being able to strike this deal in terms of
where I appreciate where GTE has to get a return on their investment, and they've found a mechanism and a way to do that. How do we do that in other areas? For example, you serve in Coos Bay, in terms of where it's a different example, and
yeah.
The legislators from Coos Bay have come to me and had the same conversation. How do we get that in terms of, is 142 a vehicle that allows those opportunities to occur in a better way in terms of, from a philosophical way, I appreciate that you have some mm-hmm. concerns in terms of language and the way it exists mm-hmm. today, but from philosophically in terms, is this the direction we need to go from a regulatory stance to give companies like GT the opportunity to say, to meet my obligations to serve, those have changed over time, or is it viewed as, you know, your phone rings, pick it up, that's my obligation?
I don't think it's as simple as your phone rings, pick it up. To give you a little bit of background on Coos Bay, Coos Bay has fiber all the way to Roseburg to U.S. West Tandem. So, and there's also a POP in Coos, AT&T has a POP in Coos Bay, which we have fiber to as well. So, so in that situation, they do have connections to the rest of the world.
So I can go back to Representative Medley, Mr. Chair.
Been there.
Yeah. He is okay.
Should be.
Okay.
Should be.
Okay.
That's how I know. Been there. I think it's a difficult question because, for example, the problem that we ran into in La Grande is we did not own any of the fiber that went through La Grande. I didn't bring my map, but the map that the PUC gave out in the packet at the beginning of the session with all the different colors for the different companies. If you look at that, GTE is like an island out there in La Grande, and there's either nothing around it or there are other phone companies. So it's difficult for us when we don't own the fiber that goes through there to provide access. And we actually did look with U.S. West at one point at putting fiber between Pendleton and La Grande, but because of the geographic area, it was just prohibitively expensive to do that. It was much more cost effective for us to try and help an interexchange carrier see that putting a POP in the general area was a more worthwhile investment. So I'm not sure there's a one-size-fits-all answer. I think a lot of it depends on the particular circumstances of the community because, again, I think anybody going into one of those communities is going to want to see the opportunity for some sort of a return on their investment.
Okay.
And I just wanted to briefly talk a little bit about 142 because I talked about La Grande.
It's not your turn yet.
We do support the voluntary aspects of Senate Bill 142. We think that's a positive step that providers can choose to invest and communities can choose to apply for the money and build what kinds of things they think are necessary in their community as opposed to somebody saying they know what the community needs and this is what we should invest in. But we do think that there needs to be a closer linkage in some of the parts of the bill between, for example, the implementation of universal service and the price caps and that kind of thing. We think that there needs to be some sort of rate rebalancing taking place at the same time as universal service is implemented as opposed to the possible 18-month lag time that's in 142.
Representative Hill? Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about rate rebalancing, you're referring to rate rebalancing as it relates to basic telephone service?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, it would be everything. You wouldn't just rebalance the basic because then that would cause you to rebalance business and others
right.
to make sure it was all revenue neutral. So basically, we are interested in continuing to work with the committee and other stakeholders to come to a solution for rural infrastructure development and move towards a more deregulated environment, but we think there could be a few improvements to Senate Bill 142A. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Shaw. I represent Sprint, and I'm pleased to be here today to speak on this important issue. Sprint provides local telephone service as well as long distance and wireless service. In Oregon, we serve about 80,000 customers, all of whom reside in rural areas. We support Senate Bill 142A because we believe it should help spur development and deployment of advanced services in rural markets. As Shelley indicated as well, Sprint has digital service to our customers with digital switches. All of our customers are 100% one party. And to the question of the interconnection between the companies, I think we've worked very well with GTE and with US West and other companies as we've identified places that have become bottlenecks because of high internet traffic and so forth in both Oregon and Washington to add more facilities in those areas. So I think that's worked well for us at this point, and I'm not sure that that's a much of a problem for us. Basically, we support the engrossed version of the bill in favor of some amendments that may have been talked about or proposed. Mr. Edvilson has mentioned the maybe the split between rural providers and urban providers from 90-10 for rural to 75-25 for urban. We certainly endorse competition, but below the 90-10, we get nervous that we're funding our competitors' infrastructure. Also, in regard to some testimony by Mr. Edvilson, we may be, in terms of overall infrastructure investment, we may be doing the schools a bigger favor by investing in network backbone than T1s. If they need the data bandwidth, there might be more economical approaches such as frame relay, which we can provide, and a number of the companies can provide that as well. To the extent possible, Sprint would like to see the development of public rather than private networks. The economics of the situation dictate that traffic aggregation, not segregation by the user, should be favored.
Let me hold you up for a second, Bruce. Representative Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Bruce, just to be clear, when you say public, you're talking about the public switch network.
Yes, I am.
And not, you're talking about a closed network, so people don't think that you're talking about government should be building a telecommunications network in the sense of using public, open to the public.
Chairman Cromwell, Representative Hill, thank you very much. That's right on the money. In line with Shelley's testimony, we do not favor placing price caps on all regulated retail services. We prefer the language in the engrossed bill with one modification that would allow the cap to be lifted on basic service or rate rebalanced at the commission's discretions for any rate rebalancing that they might deem necessary for public policy purposes such as universal service, extended area service, or other government mandates. We think without such language, without that rate rebalancing, that the Universal Service Fund could become unmanageably large. And further, if the committee believes that the Commission should maintain some control over discretionary services, then we would be receptive to some price flexibility within certain limits. In terms of regulatory workload, we certainly think that regarding paperwork and dealing with the Commission and those kinds of things, that price limitations and price cap regulation are much preferable to the rate of return regulation because of the relative simplicity involved. And I think that concludes my remarks for right now, and available for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Shaw? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Huss. I'm the Vice President for Public Policy for U.S. West and Oregon. And I'm appearing here in support of Senate Bill 142. I want to tell you a little about my own background because it is one of the things that drove us towards participating with the Rural Coalition in supporting this measure. I was born and raised in southeastern Montana in a small town called Miles City. When I was a kid growing up, the town was 12,000 people. We had airline service, we had rail service, we had trucking service, we had telephone service. We had it all. As I grew up and went off to college, we began the system of opening the markets, not deregulating, but opening markets. and eventually deregulating the services that were provided. And now I'm 55 years old, and I go home and I visit my family there. And Miles City is 8,500 people. It doesn't have rail service in terms of passenger service. It has very limited freight service. The trucking service has been reduced substantially. There is no airline service. And Miles City, like many rural communities, has felt the effects of the deregulation. When I returned to Oregon after a seven-year absence, I began to tour the state to try and reacquaint myself with Oregon and particularly the problems of Oregonians. And as we traveled around the state, I had a pattern speech that I gave, and I spent a lot of my time listening as opposed to speaking. But in the course of the speech I would give, I would talk about three things that I thought we needed to preserve telecommunications in the state of Oregon. The first one was we needed a solid universal service fund that would pay the difference between an affordable rate to be determined by the Public Utility Commission and the cost of the service. And the reason that we needed that is because in a competitive environment, which we have a growingly competitive environment in Oregon today, the old pricing system will not work. Under the old monopoly pricing system, urban supported rural, business supported local, long distance supported residential local service. If you were a rural residential user with very little toll, you got subsidies from all three services. But today, the very part of the business that is providing the majority of the subsidies, the business segment in the Portland metropolitan area, is precisely where the competitors have chosen to locate their businesses. And as a result, U.S. West today is losing access lines, not market share. We're losing market share, and that's to be anticipated when you open a competitive market. But we are, in fact, losing the number of access lines we serve in the downtown Portland area. We have less access lines today than we had at the end of 1997. And as we lose those lines, we lose our ability to provide that internal pricing support. That's precisely the reason that the federal government mandated the creation of a universal service fund in the Telecommunications Act of 96. And yet we're now three-plus years from the creation of that act, and the FCC has failed to adopt a universal service fund. Likewise, the Public Utility Commission has been addressing the issue of the universal service fund for over 4 years. They have not enacted a universal service fund. You've heard Commissioner Smith testify that a large part of that is because of the requirements of the federal government that there be some comity between what the states do and what the feds do, and because the feds haven't acted, they don't know what to do, and I have empathy for them. But the fact of the matter is that while all of this bureaucratic waiting is going on, people in rural Oregon are at risk with regard to the ability of the incumbent providers to continue to provide the very basic services. The second thing that I told people we needed was the opportunity to price and bundle services in the same fashion that our competitors do. What we are seeing in many areas is that the competitors do demographic studies and customize packages of services at a single rate based upon your particular needs. And so what you receive as a consumer may not be what your neighbor receives because they may reflect a different demographic group. Currently, under the monopoly system we have, or under the regulatory system we have, we not only have to get each service pre-approved by the commission to introduce it, then we periodically have to get permission from the Public Utility Commission through the price. But if we try and put several of those services together in a bundle, we have to go back in, have the bundle approved, and have the price approved. We went to the Public Utility Commission and we said, we would like the freedom to price bundles of services at any price below the sum of their parts. You're automatically protected against price gouging because if you tried to price above the sum of your parts, they'd go out and buy the piece parts. The commission said, no, we can't do that. You need to bring your specific packages to us, and we will look and see if they're worthy of giving you that authority per package. First one took us 6 months, first group of packages. The second group took us 2 months. We've now gone back and said, okay, we've showed you the individual packages. We're asking for the same thing we asked in the first instance. If we promise not to price our product above the sum of the piece parts, we ought to be able to price flexibly below it. We still don't have that authority. And we've come to the legislature asking for it. The third thing that we asked for was the elimination of rate of return regulation. Not the end of regulation, but the end of rate of return regulation. And there's a very simple reason for doing that. Today in America, every business is challenged to sell more products, increase their sales, introduce more products and services, and reduce their operating costs through efficiency gains. And in America, for every business except a regulated business, the effect of that is you increase your sales, you increase your profits, you are able to keep the increase in your profits. Increased profits mean increased cash. Increased cash means the ability to reinvest more in your business to allow it to grow and to provide better service for your customers. But in the regulatory environment, under rate of return regulation, if you sell more products and services and increase your profitability because rate of return regulation regulates the level of profit you have, you must reduce your prices in order to keep profits constant. If you introduce new products and services and increase your profitability, you must reduce your prices in order to keep your profits constant. If you engage in operating efficiencies and lower your cost per unit, you must reduce your prices in order to keep your profits constant. So the incentives that exist under under the regulatory practices currently are diametrically opposed to what everybody else in America is encouraged to do as a business person. What we are asking is to substitute for rate of return regulation price caps. Take the prices you have, that's it. You can never raise those prices. But if you can sell more units, if you can introduce new products and services, if you can engage in operating efficiencies and lower your cost per unit, you will be able to keep the profits like the rest of America. And the increased profits mean increased cash. The increased cash means increased ability to reinvest to the benefit of your network and your customers.
Representative Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, in the early 90s, U.S. West went to the commission and applied for the A4 regulation.
Yes.
Got increased profits, the ability to make increased profits, and then flexibility. Through that, as I understand it, U.S. West made a business decision, whether it be a good one or a bad one, and they decided to cut service levels or people and the ability to deliver service to their customers. As a result, U.S. West service quality plummeted. That happened in the past. We're looking to the future now in terms of how do we balance this out, where you're here with 142, right or wrong, this bill is wrapped around U.S. West. How do we as legislators trust U.S. West that, you know, when you say, hey, if you give me this flexibility, I'm going to invest back in the network, I'm going to do these things, my service level qualities are not going to go down, when we can look right back to the early 90s.
I think the sequence of events you described are accurate. I don't think the cause and effects are. We did engage in an A4. It was the only one that's ever been done in the state of Oregon. And we were given some limited authority to increase our profitabilities, and above a certain point we were required to share. What happened is at about the same time that the A4 went into place, shortly thereafter, U.S. West didn't engage in a desire to reduce our service quality. What we engaged in was a process called reengineering. And what we were trying to do was upgrade systems, some of which dated back into the 50s, but more importantly, what we were trying to do was push the systems of three disparate companies together. Even though we all came from an AT&T background, a Bell background, surprisingly, the systems were not exactly the same. And we were trying to operate as one unit, push those systems together, modernize them, make them more efficient, and mechanize more things, some of which were heavily labor-intensive. And what we knew is that it was the right decision. We could see competition coming, and we understood we had to become more efficient. We made a good decision. Our execution was not flawless. We assumed benefits before they occurred. We put processes into place out of sequence. The net result was our customers suffered. Expectations that had been built up over 100 years of near-perfect service were dashed. And There's no excuse for it. None. I will tell you that the people that were responsible for the execution of that program no longer work for U.S. West. That's a high price that people pay in large corporations for engaging in that. The decision to engage in reengineering turns out to be the right decision as we come out of it. But in between, we did not do a very good job. Now, there are some who seem to think that because we got into an A4, we took the money and ran. Well, if U.S. West only operated in Oregon, you might draw that conclusion. But we operate in 14 states. We re-engineered the systems in 14 states. We had service problems in 14 states. They all occurred simultaneously, and they all occurred to greater or less degrees in the same area. And most of it centered around held orders, our ability to generate the construction necessary to meet a growing demand. At the same time that was happening, the whole network, not just in Oregon but everywhere, were experiencing a change in the utilization of it. We went from historic standards where you would engineer a network for 1.5 access lines per household pass, and you would engineer your network in terms of your switching capacity and your inner office facilities for calls that lasted 2 to 2.5 minutes. That was what the historic average had been for years. The historic growth in the usage was about 5%. Well, we hit a period of time in which we now have faxes, wireless, internet, more home offices, keen lines. And what we saw was that in many instances, the usage, in fact, was 3 to 5 lines. I have 4 lines into my house. I tried to tick through one time how many telephone numbers I've got. I've got about 14 telephone numbers. You know, 5 years ago, I had 2, my business and my home. But that isn't the way we live anymore. And so when we went through, we had to add access lines. We went through established neighborhoods, which have made it more expensive and slowed the process. The switch capacity went from 2 to 2.5 minutes per call, in some instances to 2 and 2.5 hours, sometimes 2 and 2.5 days, as internet usage spread across the net. I had a conversation with a gentleman from Roseburg where we've had a huge problem. He was calling to talk about the fact that after 5 o'clock in the evening, he couldn't get on the network. He couldn't pick up his phone and get dial phone. So in desperation, what he'd do is he'd sign off the computer and use that telephone line to get on. I said, do you understand you're part of the problem? When you have that computer up and running on the internet, you've locked in a line, you've locked in a switch capacity, and you've locked in the interoffice facilities. Nobody else is able to utilize that. He didn't realize that he was a part of the problem. But we've had this re-engineering process. We've had this phenomenal growth and change in the use of the network. And either one of them would have strained us enormously. Combined, they broke our back. But we are climbing back out of that problem. We are on top of our held orders problem. We are on top of virtually every service quality measure. The network blockage continues to haunt us and will until we learn what the new engineering standards are going to require, and that's going to be based upon historic trends. But the fact of the matter is we did not take the money and run.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do we get to the, as legislators here, we're faced with a policy decision in 142, and out in the press, it becomes this issue of letting U.S. West off with something in terms of, and so as I internalize this, is how do I go back and justify to my constituents who aren't served by U.S. West in GTE territory, but how do I go back and justify to them that we do have a system in which these companies which have an obligation to serve are going to be held accountable for their service level, and the fact that, you know, there has to, you know, you can order a phone, you can get a phone, because it's become such a vital and integral part of people's lives.
Right. Well, first of all, I think consumers are protected by virtue of the fact that they're going to have price caps. They're going to know with certainty that their prices are not going to increase. In fact, under the provisions of the bill, prices can only decrease and, in fact, will decrease as a result of any draws you take from the Universal Service Fund. I remember that Representative Witt asked, what can I tell my people in urban Oregon? Are there benefits under the bill? Well, their benefits under the bill is those services that have been providing the support for the last 100 years are going to go down proportionally with whatever draws we take from the Universal Service Fund. The other part is this bill does nothing with regard to the authority of the Public Utility Commission over service quality. They retain their authority under the bill, and in fact the bill raises the fining level that is applicable and creates additional incentive. So the fact of the matter is there's no change. If this bill were defeated and we went back to where we were before, the commission would have the same authority yesterday that it will have tomorrow under the bill. So consumers remain fully protected with regard to service quality.
As new technologies in terms of U.S. West is deploying DSL, how does that issue, is U.S. West planning to deploy that out in all regions in terms of, because that could take the pressure off of the voice switches in terms of, because it will transfer it to a different type of switch, that always on constant internet traffic in terms of, I mean, is that something we can foresee regardless of 142, but...
Yeah. Chairman Hummel and Chairman Hill, we are in the process of deploying DSL. How far it's going to be deployed, I can't tell you because I can't... There are three factors that I can't judge. One is I can't judge what the actual cost of DSL is going to be in the future. We assume that, like most switching elements, we are in a declining cost. We are not in a declining cost for the whole of the network, but for switching or electronic elements, we are probably in a declining cost. So as that goes down, it makes the business case for deploying DSL greater. I'm not sure what the demand will be out there. And the third thing is I'm not sure how the suppliers are doing. I mean, our limitation right now is mostly dictated by the suppliers. There is not only U.S. West in the market demanding DSLAM units from the suppliers, but virtually everybody. GTE is active in it. Sprint's active in it. We're all in it because the DSL technology means the revitalization of the copper network. It allows us to provide the high-speed data that has otherwise been denied over the copper network. But it does provide significant operating efficiencies for us in that you now have both voice and data over the same line simultaneously. It saves a loop going to a home. And as I understand the technology, as it enters the switch, it's screened off and moved over the frame network, which means it provides relief in the capacity of the switch and the capacity of the interoffice facilities, all of which are the point where I think we're seeing the most problem now. That's due to the internet. So more people that go onto the DSL service for internet service, the more the traffic is routed over the frame network and off the regular switch network, the more that happens, the more we deload the switch network and cure some of the problems that we have been experiencing. At the same time, we are reinforcing the network as rapidly as possible. And that is a part of the recent announcement we made where we're deploying the 4 digital switches in Albany, Springfield, Grants Pass, and Roseburg. And what we haven't announced is we're also deploying 5 Lucent switches. One will go into Corvallis, and the other 4 will replace the 1As in the Portland metropolitan area. And we haven't made an announcement because we don't have firm dates, but my last conversation led me to believe that all of those would be deployed before the middle of the year 2000. As soon as we get firm ship dates from the manufacturer, we can tighten those up, and we'll be making those announcements in the communities.
Okay. Thank you. Any more follow-up? Representative King, and then Representative Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Huss. I want to thank you for going to Oak Ridge. That was a real interesting meeting, and it was helpful to see, you know, your insight there. And I was impressed by the, you know, by the citizens of Oak Ridge, that they were pretty upset about the issue. quality services my main concern. I think that giving a good rate of return can be done any number of ways. And we all remember, a lot of us remember that we had poor economy in the 1980s and then we downsized at the beginning of this decade, and then the economy came back a lot. And a lot of that comeback was telecommunications. It seems like we get a lot of, you know, call centers that want to, more than we can handle, want to move into Eugene, like to get up some of them into Oak Ridge. And so at the same time you were downsizing, we had, you know, explosion of service, and then, you know, the internet explosion in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, coupled with e-commerce, you know, coming on top of that, you know, clearly you guys, you know, ended up way behind the curve. Your comments in terms of not being able to provide level of service for desire of each community when you don't know what their desire rates are going to be, because we could have, like Oak Ridge ended up having like a 700-fold increase in the internet use where other communities didn't have that. But I still don't see a very good picture of how we get back to quality service. And, you know, Oregon's, you know, a big state for us, but in your case, you've got 14 states
right
to deal with, and we don't know the issues, you know, that you face in other states in terms of what their economies are demanding of you and their communities. And so I'm wondering how we get back to quality of service. I assume the quality of service is better in the urban areas than it is out in the rural areas, but I don't have as good a picture of that, frankly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, there was an article in the Business Journal a couple of weeks ago in which the reporter actually went out and tried to find the facts around the myths of service quality. And he examined service quality standards as well as performance across the United States by most of the major providers. And what he found was that U.S. West was about in the middle of the pack, and that in many instances, Oregon was receiving as good or better services in most places. Now, that's not to say that Oregonians may not have higher expectations. Our responsibility is to meet those expectations. But we have created an environment, and we are in large part responsible for having done that because we let service slip. But we've created an environment in which there is this perception that somehow or another Oregonians are getting third world service, and they're not. There is a perception that belies experience. We have done a huge amount of polling and focus group studies about that, and what we find is people's perception is significantly different than their experience. I don't want to walk away from this saying that we've got service quality solved, because we will never have service quality solved. The minute we think we do and let up on the pedal, we're going to fall right back. It's a problem we've got to attack every day of the week, and I think we're doing it. It's unfortunate that I was not able to have Fred Faust, who is the vice president in charge of the network for Oregon, come with me. Fred has earned appropriate the title of Mr. Fix-It, and the progress we have made in Oregon over the last 18 to 24 months have been rather significant, and they're due in large part because of him. The other part that it's due in large part to is some people out there that just work their tails off. I do not go to a city that I don't stop at the garages and talk to the people. And I know that they're out there working hard and doing a heck of a job in terms of meeting expectations, and particularly in the rural communities, because those are their customers are also their friends and neighbors. The kids play on the same softball team. They run into each other at the grocery store. Those people are even more closely attuned to the service quality in their communities than perhaps the people in Portland are, and they do a heck of a job in meeting expectations.
If I could follow
up.
I think it's fair that we're not all going to get our wishes, and I'm getting by with my 14.4 modem at home when I wish I had the 56. But I'm wondering if you feel that 142 gives both you and I'll say the PUC for back, lack of a better way of saying Oregon, has the, is going to get the planning tools to be able to identify, you know, what are the needs, what are appropriate, you know, benchmarks for saying, you know, that we're doing quality service job, particularly in the rural area, again, because I'm not so familiar with the urban area, and I know that, you know, clearly that is a place where you can make enough profit to be happy. I don't think it losses in urban and rural areas, but the rate of return, you know, certainly would be below acceptable.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, yes, I think Senate Bill 142 does, and let me tell you why. First of all, what Senate Bill 142 does is permit us greater access to the kind of funds we need to make the investments. Oregon, in Oregon, we have invested a little over $200 million each year for at least the last 3 years. We are on target to invest over $200 million again this year. Over the past 3 years, not counting 1999, we're at somewhere near $700 million. So it's not a lack of funds. We try and prioritize our spending at the beginning of the year, and we try and follow that, but when there are different demands or different exigencies that come along, we need to, like everybody else with a budget, make changes in order to accommodate those. Our problem is more, I think, in the context of understanding where the growth is going to come from and what it's going to look like and where it's going to occur and when. And that's something we don't have a very good lock on. We have brought forecasters back to the state of Oregon in order to get a better handle on where growth is going to occur. And even at that, because we're in a whole new environment with the telephone usage, we are still picking our way through that. But I do believe that the right incentives occur in Senate Bill 142. There's the increased opportunity to make and keep profits. There is a fund that would not otherwise be spent in rural Oregon because you can't make a business case for it. And the commission's authority over service quality standards remains intact. And the fines go up.
One quick follow-up, maybe.
One more quick follow-up, and then we do need to move on.
Of course, we do both acknowledge that there is some self-fulfilling prophecy that if you have the hardware in place, some growth will occur, but if there's no hardware, then
that's right.
The growth will have to go someplace else.
Yeah, I think we heard that from the gentleman from Lake County, is that they're having trouble attracting business because of the perception of the infrastructure, and we have seen that in community after community we've talked to. The fact of the matter is we have also seen the kind of experiences that Shelley described in LeGrand, where we've gone through a cooperative process in Grants Pass and in Klamath Falls and most recently in Milton Freewater, in which we've been able to do that collaborative effort with the community in order to attract call centers who need high-capacity networks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Deckert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple quick questions, Larry. In terms of, first, I guess, in general, because I've wrestled with this in terms of price caps versus our rate of return, and seeing the advantages of it, I guess one general overreaching concern, that, and it's been largely from consumer groups and residential users, and wondering why, in your sense, that they seem to be so viscerally opposed to this move.
It's hard to say. I think there's a psychology that goes... I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, if I may. I'm not used to this format. I think there's a psychology of consumers where they don't have choices, that they get angry at their provider easily, and so they are distrustful in part. I think there is a psychology that goes along with it. I think there's also a fear on their part, and we see some of the consumer advocate groups fueling that fear that prices are going to go up. Well, I'm hard-pressed to understand how those prices are going to go up if you've got price caps. Now, I understand that the Senate bill does not have the price caps on services other than residential services, and maybe at odds with our friends here, but while I think that's the right economic thing to do, I also understand that in the political climate today, that's probably not a wise thing to do from a policy decision. We would encourage you to put the price caps back on, just like was proposed in the original Senate bill and was removed by the Senate. It wasn't our idea. I don't know who they were yielding to, but they did, and I just think it's not probably politically palatable. So I don't know why they're worried. They get stability. They get a universal service fund, which is going to ensure those prices aren't going to go up over time. A way to manage and ensure that affordable service is available to all Oregonians for the foreseeable future. Absent something like that, we are going to begin to look like the trucking industry, the airline industry, the railroad industry, and others where the markets have been open to competition. Competition has driven prices towards their cost, and the net result is rural America has gone without the benefit of those services because the cost of providing them has gotten so great that they can't afford to pay them.
And then one other question, Mr. Chair, and it's regards to rural build-out.
Yes.
One of the concerns that I've heard is in terms of the 90-10 breakdown that Mr. Shaw talked about, the concern that it's not a strategic enough process and that perhaps that existing projects would be used with the 90-10 breakdown, or that we're just not thinking globally enough in terms of all of Oregon and how we would strategically want to get that rural build-out that we all want.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Decker, I sometimes think people look at this legislation not for what it intends to do, but for what the most nefarious of motives could create under it. I'm not sure whether the language in the bill is tight enough to ensure that the infrastructure build-out is for incremental construction. That is our intent. If the language needs to be tightened. What we are talking about is the kind of infrastructure build-out for which there is not a business case. If there was a business case, then we would build it, or GTE would build it, or one of those 50 other companies that are authorized to provide service in our territory would build it. We're talking about build-outs in instances where there is not an economic justification for the build-out. That's the purpose for the citizens panel, is to do the evaluation and try and make the prioritization. Now, hopefully, they will take some time to try and look across the state of Oregon and make decisions about what is best in an overall network approach. Hopefully, they will look at the enterprise network that you heard Don Mazziotti talk about and understand that this is a complement to it and not a competitor or should not be ignored. There is an opportunity to make the enterprise network more robust in terms of reaching some of the places that it is not going to reach. So I think those type of factors are all things that should be considered in the deployment of it. I don't think that the government should try and engineer what the network build-out of Oregon should look like.
Okay, we're close, and then we're going to need to adjourn to go back to the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Competitors, competition, you guys are the incumbents. You have an obligation to open your networks and your facilities for interconnection. How are we assured in this process? Because, I mean, I get into the news clips on the Internet where, you know, I read where the incumbent... You know, well, yep, we're to the letter of the law. You know, you can't use the bathroom. You know, you can't park in the parking lot because we have no obligation to do that. I mean, it's to the point of ludicrous. How do we bring some reality back into this process in that you guys just simply say, you know, for a fair price, my doors are open, there's the, you know, space on the floor. I mean, last session, I don't think we had an opportunity this session to go take a tour of the Capital Center facility. There's no lacking for floor space there. We toured the AT&T facility. There's no lacking for floor space there in terms of so that competitors have a fair and equitable opportunity to interconnect so that consumers have greater choice. How do we do that? You're the incumbent.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Chairman Hill, this bill does nothing to disturb that responsibility or the authority of the commission under the Telecommunications Act of 1993. That remains in place. Again, whether this bill passes or doesn't, the ability to achieve those goals exists yesterday and will exist tomorrow. The fact of the matter is that we are moving steadily towards a competitive environment. Those who choose to serve the market have been able to interconnect, to exchange traffic, to purchase the necessary elements. Those who choose to complain have done exactly that. And it's hard for me to believe that companies with worldwide resources that dwarf those available to U.S. West have been unable to enter the market for any other reason than that they didn't desire to enter the market.
Any other questions?
Just one quick one. And this is really for anybody on the panel that wants to answer. And one idea that's been kicked around is setting a minimum threshold of service quality standards that would have to be met before providers could get out from under rate of return. And I'm wondering what any of you think of that.
I don't agree with that. I do agree that the commission should engage in the creation of minimal service standards. The service standards that the commission has adopted have at least been portrayed to me by members of the commission as targets. Those that would say that if you reach those, you're providing excellent service. And I think the commission, by and large, has administered those rules in that fashion. They don't rush off to court every time somebody varies from those or drops below them. The first thing they do is watch for trends. And the second thing is if there is a trend developing, they haul your tail down there and ask you what you're going to do about it. And in some instances, you develop, execute, and commit to a plan to make the improvements and you follow them. The idea of making minimum standards and targets, which are two different things, and giving the commission the authority to fine below the minimum standards and require attention to plans to go from the minimum standards up towards the target is something that appeals to me. But I don't think it ought to be a precondition, because I don't know what those minimum standards are, and if they're the same standards that are in existence today, which are not minimum standards, they're targets, I think that would be very difficult.
Okay. Thank you. With that, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming up. With that, what I would like to do is, for the benefit of the committee and for the audience, on Monday is when we would anticipate being back on this bill, Senate Bill 142, and any other bills that we need to kick out. My intention would be to call up the consumer panel. And then to call up the competitors panel or providers panel, and then to open up testimony. And I think that when we finally do go into, and then that would conclude on, hopefully we can conclude the testimony on Monday, then I would anticipate going into a work session on probably Friday of next week. No. Anyway, well,
I guess
we'll discuss. We'll decide on the schedule after that. We may need to take more testimony after that as well. So we'll see where we are with that. And so for right now, I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 142. And without objection, I'll adjourn the meeting. And remember, members.